Hello, I'm Alex Wisser. I'm a member of Kando School of Cultural Adaptation, and this is Groundswell. In this podcast, you'll hear Adam Blakester invite a series of speakers to talk about change and adaptation. This topic was at the very heart of the Groundswell program, which was part of the Pulse of the Earth Festival in the Living Classroom in Bingara, New South Wales. The speakers were farmer and author Charles Massey, agroecologist and artist Rachel Lawrence, artist Ian Millis, and actor and geographer Ananth Gopal. The live sound engineer for this session was Matthew McRae from McSound Electronics in Urala.
To kick us off this morning, we're going to explore this inherent theme of change in more detail, so the science and art of adaptation. And so we've got four speakers, and I'm going to introduce Charlie first because he's going to lead us off. And I'm quite excited about this because Charlie, my understanding, and Laura's pointed me to this, and I've read a lot about Charlie and listened to his presentations here, but I haven't yet read Call of the Reed Warbler. I only bought a copy a couple of days ago, but this idea of adaptation and change is just inherent in everything we're doing, and Laura's pointed me to the fact that this is probably one of the really core areas of interest that Charlie has explored. So it's one thing to identify opportunity and have a vision, but how do we get from a place and a state where things are a particular way to a different place, a different state, and that change in between and deep adaptation, I think, is what we're talking about if we name it really straightly. So Charlie's going to lead us off with a presentation, about 15 minutes of his perspectives on adaptation, and then our three other speakers are going to both draw on their experience of change and adaptation, but also respond to Charlie. First of our other three session speakers is Rachel Lawrence, who some of you might have heard Rachel yesterday. Yes? Oh, yeah, sorry, that'd be a good thing. So Charlie, sorry, is here. Apologies. So Rachel Lawrence. Oh, stand up properly. So Rachel was in the workshop on the future, on the main stage yesterday. But for those of you who didn't hear her intro yesterday, Rachel's an agroecologist, also an artist, a potter, is near the completion point of a research degree, looking at beneficial role of insects in agroecology systems. And is also working with Southern New England Land Care, and particularly on a project around the Malpas catchment, which is one is main water supply. So for those of you who don't know, Armidale, 150k from here, has got water restrictions for the first time in history, which is reflective of the context. And that's no pressure work zone that Rachel's in. Our third session members, Ian Millis. Ian, would you mind? Yeah, so Ian's up the front. So Ian is a co-founder of Kandos School of Cultural Adaptation, KCA, who, as we've spoken about numerous times throughout the last couple of days, are pivotal in the backstory to what we're here doing, Pulse of the Earth and Regeneration. And Ian has a long career in a whole lot of change roles. And I say that not to emphasise age, I say it to emphasise the expansiveness of Ian's backstory is really considerable. And work like the Green Bands in Sydney that was, for me personally, a real source of inspiration, and seeing, you know, labour and environmental and cultural and historical movements come together, and the union movement more generally that Ian's been involved with. And so I see Ian very much as continuing to challenge and stretch us in our sense of vision and values, really, in terms of what's important and where are we headed to. And he did that very beautifully with an artistic piece as an artist in his own right at the Futurelands, the second Futurelands that KSCA did in Kandos, where, amongst other things, Ian created a poster that portrayed just a possible vision, a range of different ideas for Kandos, and it was quite fascinating the way that became a point of engagement and stimulus. What seemed quite simple to me as a grouping of ideas, but some people found it incredibly inspiring, others wanted to get pitchforks out. Metaphorically, pitchforks. And then our fourth panel member is Ananth. Ah. Nice to meet you. Who I've now met as well. So Ananth's an actor, geographer, facilitator of change, learning, developmental processes, has involvement in playback theatre, so I'm quite excited where this session might go, and an organisation called, is it Polycala? Yep. That does work in this space. So has a particular passion for enabling change from an individual through to groups, organisations, communities as a whole. And I think particularly as the sense I'm getting from reading your backstory is how you weave these different skills and experiences you have into not only those processes, but you actually taking different roles, sort of shape-shifting to affect group dynamics in change processes. So it's quite exciting to have these four very knowledgeable, experienced, diverse creatives on our session this morning. So no further ado, I'll hand over to Charles to lead us off with the first presentation. We'll then come back to the others to respond. Panel discussion and time for some questions, all going well. Over to you.
Thanks, Adam, and welcome everyone. Sometimes not sure if the after lunch session or the Sunday morning session is a graveyard session, but you all look bright-eyed. You'll notice up there the dreaded word Anthropocene, and there's without doubt we now have a huge urgency to start changing and adapting, and what I'm going to do to set up the other speakers' talks and our discussion is just a quick general canter across the space of adaptation and change. And I'll begin with a major philosophical statement that no one likes change except babies with wet nappies. And that's true. My PhD that led to the book was studying 60 of Australia's leading regenerative farmers, and in 60% of the cases, what forced them to change was a major life shock that cracked open that, if you like, that carapace of their mind. So the natural selection, which obviously Charles Darwin initiated that thinking, is really what's behind it. In shaping all classes of traits in organisms, it's really become the central dogma of evolutionary thinking. And I'll just get rid of some of the broad descriptions to set up the discussion. Adaptation, dynamic evolutionary process that delivers genetically inherited specializations in structure and function that permit organisms and animals to survive under a given set of environmental conditions. And these adaptations can be physiological, structural, or behavioural. And I guess what we're talking about here, from our species' point of view, is mainly behavioural. And all adaptations should help organisms to survive in their ecological niches. But if you think about the Anthropocene, not always. And as a leading thinker on evolutionary theory says, Niles Eldridge, adaptation is the heart and soul of evolution. So that's just a couple of obvious examples of sort of adaptive evolution, using the word adaptive. The lotus bird, both in the same environment in the top end, long spidery feet to walk on lily pads, specialised beak for eating insectivores, side by side with a spoonbill, big long solid feet to wade, and a bill that can sift through for microorganisms and midges, etc. And then there's things like convergent evolution, where flight can evolve in different phyla separately. So it's a fascinating process, evolution. In humans, it's occurred. If you look at the squat build, wide solid build of Eskimos for heat conservation versus tall, lean Maasai with long, large surface area to get rid of heat. And same with skin colour. Indigenous people of the very dark-skinned in our Western Desert country, compared to us Northern Europeans, most of us, who've come out of a cold environment where you want to maximise a whiter skin to fix vitamin D in that sort of environment. A classic case in evolutionary adaptation is this melanism in moths. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, most of them were white, and on the left, if you probably can't see it, but on the sort of moths and things you're virtually invisible, a white moth for predators like birds. And then within a decade or two of the Industrial Revolution, when the trees and fence posts became dark, the white moths began to be wiped out in huge numbers until there was a mutation of a dark moth. And they then became a major part of that that population. It's now switching back. So it can be reasonably rapid, those sort of physiological adaptations. Another interesting one, which I experienced in 1981 on a mountaineering trip to the Tibetan Plateau, was I had the privilege of spending a few days with Tibetan herders whose probably lifestyle hadn't changed in 10,000 years. The breakthrough for them was finding animals that were domesticated, like sheep, cows, horses, that you could milk. So you could get your food without having to kill an animal. That was a big breakthrough for those nomadic herds people. And so domestication occurred maybe 10 or 11,000 years ago of those sort of species you could milk, etc. And until about 8,000 years ago, adults couldn't digest milk. They didn't have that lactose digestible gene. And then a mutation occurred which enabled that to happen, but mainly in people from this area and northwestern Europe. And now about 35% of our global population carries that gene. So just another example of those sorts of adaptations. But the one I want to focus on is behavioural cultural. And one of the great founders of animal behaviour or ethology was Konrad Lorenz. That's him swimming around with those beautiful geese that he imprinted to follow him, thinking he was mother. He said, behaviour and social structure, like other biological phenomena, can be even viewed as organs. In other words, extensions of the genetics that exist because of their superior adaptive value. However, I'm saying our behavioural adaptations aren't always good for species preservation. And what happened in the Second World War with the attempted extermination of the Jews is a classic example. It's not really a species favouring mechanism culturally. And so I'm throwing the idea out, are we this advanced hominid brilliantly adapted, or do we have a fatal flaw in our cultural behaviour? And as a well-known evolutionary thinker, Sir Peter Medawar said, it's a profound truth that nature does not necessarily know best, that genetical evolution, as he calls it, is a story of waste, makeshift, compromise and blunder. And we haven't been around that long compared to some species. I hope we're not going to be a major blunder. And we've discussed that yesterday. Here we are as a species, now threatening our entire environment and therefore our own survival. And that's, I think, why I'm setting this context for today, as adaptation is going to be critical. Can we do it fast enough is the question. Mentioned that yesterday, the great acceleration that's led to it through our behaviour, the post-1960s takeoff of social and Earth system trends, but also the parallel rise in modern diseases, which is now starting to kill us even without climate change and all those sorts of things. And that's what we're facing, these dilemmas as the as climate change and other Earth system destabilisation is coming quicker than anyone's anticipated. It seems to be accelerating. And we're going to have to experience more increasing heat waves, increased deaths in the elderly. One of the statistics not discussed is those Black Saturday fires in Victoria a few years ago. I think about 180-odd people were burnt in them over 48 hours. What the media didn't cover was that double that number died in institutions for mental patients and the elderly. It's not as sexy or dramatic as a bushfire, but that's the sort of thing that we're going to be confronting. From heat stress, yep. And we're already experiencing a change in disease pathology in Australia. Dengue fever's now moving down from the north, and Ross River virus spreading. It's going to be a better environment for mosquitoes, et cetera, et cetera. So we're going to have to adapt in many ways. I asked some of the tennis players at the Australian Open a few years ago And as I showed yesterday, implications for farming are going to be huge. You know, we're getting more and more temperatures over 40. We keep fallowing ground, don't have it well covered. Temperatures over 40 on the surface get to over 60, only about half a centimetre down. Not too good for soil biology. And it's all because, I won't go into it, it's all because of this shift from what was a species in medieval, but particularly indigenous cultures that treasured the earth, didn't see ourselves as separate to it. As was mentioned yesterday, post the scientific revolution, we've got to this mechanical mindset where the earth now is something we extract. We don't now see that our future is tied indivisibly with its health. What's behind it, I mentioned yesterday on stage, is this great cultural story that we tell ourselves, like all civilizations, but in my view, it's a suicidal story. The dominant paradigm driven by governments and multinationals is economic rationalism, growth for the sake of growth, ergo endless destruction from endless growth. And that's what we've got to change, and it's not going to come from the top, so it's up to us. It's that underground revolution, playing on the soil and other things. As Paul Hawkins said, we're stealing the future, selling it in the present, and calling it GDP. It's crazy. And he also said, talking to him the other day, because his next major work is going to be on adaptation, of which regenerative agriculture will be the first of the major three. We've really only got one generation to turn it around. We have to bloody adapt very quickly. And we've got to rapidly adapt to our new world environment and to turn it around. It's that underground insurgency I mentioned. And that means regeneration of our landscapes, the way we grow and eat food, and our cityscapes, of our economy, of our education and our society, and above all, of the great story that we tell ourselves. And Damon's great film last night was covering a lot of this sort of stuff, brilliantly through the eyes of that next generation. So remember that adaptation is a dynamic evolutionary process that fits organisms to their environments, ostensibly enhancing our evolutionary fitness. And what we're now talking about here, I think, is regeneration, whether it's agriculture, reclaiming the urban spaces, new food cultures, new design for economies and politics. In other words, moving to regeneration and not plunder. Reconnecting children to nature that I covered yesterday, and deeply embedding an ethic to care for, regenerate Mother Earth. We have to start talking about Mother Earth because it's the one mother that really sustains us. So what I'm saying is we need a new and great cultural story. The one we've got now is drastically broken and it's suicidal. And I won't go through that. You know what I'm talking about now, and the others, great presenters over these 2 days. There's a whole range of having a regenerative agriculture, reclaiming our food systems, urban spaces, our culture, and self-sufficiency and independence. We're captured by the big industrial powers. We're not truly independent yet. Redesigning our economies to regeneration, not plunder. It's all part of the adaptation. Reconnecting children with Mother Nature. Get them to wonder again. Off the devices. We discussed these statistics last night. And deeply embedding an ethic that cares for and regenerates Mother Earth. It's got to be our prime survival goal. And so to wrap it up before we throw it open to the others, we've got to adaptively create a new and central cultural story. One of love and regeneration, not plunder. One of reverence and wonder. One of collaboration, interconnection, not heartless, selfish exploitation. We have to live for that seventh generation, that American Indian view of the longevity of what we do impacts 7 generations downstream. If we don't do this, we won't be able to save our species and our planet. So it's a big ask. And I think it's only appropriate that we've got this session to start today and finish with a thought of Charles Darwin. Can we do it? He's saying it's not the strongest of the species that survives, nor the most intelligent that survives. It's the one that is most adaptable to change. So that's our challenge, and That's the context for today, I think. So thanks, Adam.
Thank you.
A bit of food for thought. We'll get that done by morning tea. Yeah, it's a profound space container to create for us. You're talking profound change of who we are, culture reflecting identity, purpose, meaning. Sorry, watch the coffee. It's really quite rare. And in a generation, and setting it up for seven. So there we go. There's our scope of work. I didn't talk about order, but I wondered, Ian, whether you might be willing to go next. Well, I thought one by one for this, where they're each having, yeah, because it's 5-7 minutes each. Yep, we're really well prepared. So yeah, I thought Ian, then Rachel, then Ananth, if that's all right. And so what works for you, Ian, in terms of where you want to be?
No, that's right.
Yeah, all right.
It's a bit hard to talk to an audience that's behind you.
Yeah, exactly. And do you want to be up on the riser or are you... Yeah, okay. How's that?
Age is wearying me.
Is that all right for you?
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
Look, in many ways, I can't say it better than Charlie said it. He's managed to cover the issues perfectly, not just the straightforward biological and scientific issues, but also the whole issue of human culture. And that's my background in all of this. I mean, I started out as a comparatively conventional artist working in the art world, but I started to realise at a certain point that why is it that art is an interesting thing? It's an interesting thing because it makes people think about the world differently. And so let's actually investigate much more why do people think about the world differently and who are the people who make you think about the world differently. And as a very young person at the time, you know, in my late teens and early 20s, I encountered the very beginnings of the Green Band movement. And so I started working with the Green Band movement and the community resident action movement. And this made me realise initially that in fact, an artist is not necessarily just a person who's producing product for the art world. An organisation can be an artist in the fact that a whole group of people can actually work to make people understand the world differently and make the world behave differently. And fortunately, at the time, I also had another friend who was an art critic who was very supportive of me. And what he later on, this is Donald Brook, who later on described this as the role of the artist was mimetic innovation, that culture ran through cultural memes and that the role of the artist was to actually change those memes. Although we should turn this definition on its head. There are people who call themselves artists, but they're just manufacturing product for an art market. The people we should really think about as artists are the people who are out there changing the way we understand the world. And you look at that retrospectively, you know, you see that various people change the world in various ways and they're the ones you call artists. Now, I first tried to apply that by working with the art institutions, which was to have an exhibition of P.A. Yeomans at the Art Gallery of New South Wales and just put him in there in the same way that you would put an artist in that context. Look at this guy who didn't just invent a different form of agriculture, but who actually set out to tell everybody about it. You know, he created his own media. He created his own education system. He worked very hard at this. Now, strangely enough, at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, the exhibition almost happened, and then the trustees, the curators and everyone supported it. The trustees got wind of it and cancelled it 2 months before it was meant to happen. But fortunately, many years later, Lucas Eileen came to me and said, why don't we actually do something about that exhibition? And we did a little summary version of it in an exhibition in Melbourne. And the Art Gallery of New South Wales sort of came back and said, oh, maybe we made a mistake. you know, and, you know, why don't you put in an application? We might consider it again. So it happened in 2013. And this is relevant very much to that idea of how ideas work and how you develop things in the world. It needs a context. It needs it effectively a cultural niche, an ecological niche, that when the time is right, the idea will actually then happen. You plow into it as soon as you want to, right? But sometimes you have to wait a very long time. In that case, it was 38 years between when I first thought of it and between when Lucas and I finally managed to do it. And again, without Lucas, it probably never would have happened. So a whole lot of things have to fall into place to make all these things happen. And that's, in a sense, the point that I'd like to make here, right? I'm interested in how you generate cultural change. You do it by dealing with cultural memes, understanding the cultural memes that are operating at the time. The most problematic one we are dealing with right now is neoliberalism, which is the idea that everything has to be monetized. Everything has to work financially. That's the only values that matter. Now, that's already failing massively, right? And so, and things often appear at their strongest just before they finally fail. It looks very strong right now. It's also very clear what its problems are and that how it will fail within the very near future. Now, how do you go about building other things within that? You do it by modelling alternatives of various sorts, which is what I did with that poster at Candos, which was I created a Candos which didn't exist. And yet some of the things that were in that poster, because of people in Candos like Alex and Georgie or Laura, these things have actually come to happen, you know? And it's because we basically created this sort of it was just quite literally something done at the local instant printer, you know, like it was that small, you know? Sometimes you just plant this little seed and try and hope that it will take off. Everything starts with a little seed like that. If you try and build it from the top down and build a whole organization to do this, it won't happen. If you start with just gathering up, building a small community of interest, a small number of people, letting the whole thing develop, that's how you generate the sort of cultural change that's necessary. And I would say this should never be confused with the idea of, if you stop using plastic straws, it will all change, you know. Yes, small personal things that you might do are important, but the changes that are needed in the world are on a massive national, international, industrial scale, but you only get that industrial scale to happen by starting with small communities of interest which slowly build up a critical mass around the place. And sometimes it seems like nothing's happening. It goes for a really long time before everything just finally goes pop and it all happens, right? So even though I know we are now reaching a crisis and we have very little time, I also would sort of caution people that you have to have a certain amount of patience and you have to actually just, you know, eat an elephant one mouthful at a time sort of thing. You know, you've just got to slowly just wear away at it, wear away at it, wear away at it until you get there. That it? Yeah. So, I mean, at this point I'll hand over, but that gets me to exactly the point that I wanted to get to. So.
Thanks, Ian. I love this idea of the context, and Ian described there a cultural, and then I think you tacked ecological niche. So this idea of, in the way adaptation occurring in a niche which pre Homo sapiens sapien was what we call the natural world, like as if we're not part of it. But we've extended that with cultural technological niches. The niche of adaptation in Sydney CBD didn't exist before we came along. So yeah, what are these cultural niches and how might we nurture that niche and context such that this change might precipitate the crisis requirements that often we talk about? Mm. Thanks, Ian. It's great. So our second speaker, Rachel Lawrence. Over to you.
Great. Oh, I'll try and weave something in between the two. As a scientist, I'm going to come back to the evolution story, but I will say, as a scientist who, and thank you to Charlie because you've helped me make sense of the narrow focus of science and trying to fit it into a very complex system, and that's the kind of system that I'm working in, grazing management agriculture. So in terms of evolution, a concept that I was introduced to, which some of you may have heard of, is the idea of us as a species as a superorganism. And are we just like any other superorganisms like ants, termites, bee colonies, this big thing that acts as one organism that ultimately is incredibly successful, alters its environment, but ultimately, in a lot of cases, uses up all its resources and crashes. So are we, as one organism, intelligent enough to see our way through and make the choice not to do that? And I think you could maybe think of us as divide us into a few superorganisms, and Charlie pointed out that evolution, it's not kind of a one-directional thing where you get this one fantastic change and it succeeds and it evolves into a whole new thing. There's a whole lot of waste that goes along with that, a whole lot of unsuccessful adaptations. And I think there's so much hope in this couple of days. It's fantastic to be soaking it in. And another idea that being in this space I've been introduced to is this idea that there are so many organisations working in this regenerative space, and they're all operating under the radar. I remember seeing a list, and it was like the Star Wars thing, where just this list that just went on and on and on. And they're all kind of under the radar at the moment. They're not mainstream, and there's a power in that, because once they pop their head up and they are kind of torn down, and we're all exploring these ways and all making these connections. And Adam's introduced me to this idea of networks, all these nodes in the network. And if one falls out, it's okay, because you've got all these others that are sharing ideas. And when the proverbial hits the fan, which arguably it already has, these things are just will come in and take over. And perhaps there'll be some colonies of us as a superorganism that have managed to gather together all those ideas and experiences, and we've made the mistakes, and somehow work our way through so that we're not one of those superorganisms that crashes and burns. And then I think, just to come back to Ian's, like, we all despair, we all wonder what we can do as individuals, and there's only so much, because you're working up against some huge, powerful vested interests. But you look at the change and the adaptation since Craig Rucastle, I think that's how you say his name, his documentary about the war on waste, and the changes that have come about because of that. You've got plastic-free July, we've plastic-free all these other other times that people are doing that, and really questioning, like, we've just taken for granted that we've got all this stuff available to us, and it's like, yeah, you just got to step back and go, this is just insane. And see, everyday person is kind of taking that on board. And in the farming space, agricultural space, so I'm doing a lot of work in grazing management, ecology with a bit of insect stuff in it. And I'm really very aware of this, like the innovators and the people that have paved the way with all this stuff that Charlie's interviewed and researched. The courage of that is incredible, but there's this massive chunk of people in that middle space that we just have to get through to those people somehow if we want to start to shift that direction and shift that momentum. And there will always be ones that get left over in that ant's nest over there and don't come this way. But there's so much science out there that already supports changes that people can make. Just simple things like maximising the amount of ground cover you keep, altering stocking rates in accordance to kind of what's going on with the environment. We know that all these things happen, managing sensitive areas carefully. We know these things should be done, but they're not. And then that's, to me, relates back to Charlie's, all the work around the mindset, the resistance to it, and the focus on just short-term productivity. if we can get into that, start working with those people just with simple measures, support them somehow financially, morally, socially, incentivize better management on a broader scale, maybe we can start to get a bit more change of those people that are a little bit resistant to try and shift them over towards this ant's nest or termite nest, and perhaps we can adapt successfully in the end with small changes of all of us. So.
I love that. That for me is like a metaphor of your research, from the micro to the macro. So this picture I got of all of these small changes and pioneers, and as you said, in evolution, it is not a linear, mechanistic, reductionist concept. There is a huge amount of variation and adaptation in biological evolution that doesn't come through. What are we, about 2%, I think, today, of all life that's ever existed on Earth is still alive today, including us. So here we are, we're the 4.5 billion years. Billion years of evolution and we're all still here, but 98% of it is gone. Now we're talking cultural adaptation, so what's the waste rate? I don't know, it could even be 99.9 repeater percent doesn't get through. So from those micro examples, but then the network and the idea of a superorganism, and then how does that scale up, and this idea of nodes or concentration points of people and communities. I think we're one of them. Does that mean we're going to get through this evolutionary moment? I think that's what we're trying to work out. Thanks, Rachel. And Anth, you are going to tie it up. Well, you'll solve it for us, I think, in a performance piece. I do. I'll give you the microphone. Please join me in welcoming Anth.
Can I just begin by saying how grateful I am to share this space with you and to be on country that's been cared for consistently for over 65,000 years. And I've come over from Victoria and I still feel like I'm catching up with the acceleration of transport that has brought me here. So I still feel like I'm grounding, and it's a real pleasure to be here. That coffee cup business got me thinking. A couple of weeks ago, now my wife has a need to optimize our home space such that it works, as far as she sees it, best. I'm still getting over it. So I came home and I noticed that my beloved 1960s Italian Atomic remake, it's a beautiful coffee machine made by a guy in Sydney, was moved from its position on the countertop over here to over there. And this really upset me because I wasn't consulted. And I know where the coffee machine goes best because I wake up in the morning and make her the coffee, because that was one of the things that I said in our vows, that I would always make you coffee in the morning. So I proceeded to have a bit of a barney with her about where the coffee machine should be placed. And she'd put it in a place that really was exactly the same as the other, because it has two power points. The grinder and the coffee machine can sit next to each other, the same as the other dang place, which has two power points so that the grinder and the coffee machine could sit next to each other. Now, am I just a petty fool? The answer is yes. Or is there something inside that silly anecdote? I want to put to you that none of us are averse to change itself. We're not change-averse, because as Charlie said earlier, it's not change itself that we have an aversion to, and I want to build on that profound point that you began with about wet nappies. I want to put to you that we are loss-averse. We're not change-averse because we're not stupid. We're loss-averse because we invest And I invest my identity, my sense of familiarity, my sense of knowing that I have some say in the configuration of our household, such that when the coffee machine changes from point A to point B, I feel at least temporarily disoriented. And at this point, I know I don't have a lot of time, but I just want you to turn to each other and just to share, maybe for 30 seconds, a little thing, a little stupid thing that you are banal in your aversion to change. Maybe it's the particular cereal brand that you like is no longer stocked. Maybe it's your barista that you really like the way in which she makes that particular double shot ristretto or whatever. Just turn to each other and acknowledge the humanity of each other and your change aversion. At the very least, say hello. Look how much energy is in that conversation. There's a lot of laughter. There's a lot of, I even saw people kind of hugging each other and having a chat. You know, there's a lot in there. Now, I've heard a lot of powerful minds put together and synthesize centuries and millennia of thinking. And I'm afraid I'm not as smart as Charlie and Ian and Rachel. I have a simpler mind. And I've been trying to think about adaptation. And at least for me in my simple mind, when it comes to loss aversion, it feels clear to me at least, and I want to know what you feel too afterwards, that the word change is doing a bit of work. It's doing work on the space of growth. Change equals growth, but it's also doing work, semantic work, in the space of loss, in the space of grief, in the space of resistance. So this word is Janus faced because it encodes the optimism and energy of possibility, but it also encodes the sorrow and resistance to loss. So what I want to put to you is that adaptation is fundamentally three-part. What do we want to keep? What do we want to let go of and have to let go of in order to grow? Keep, let go, grow. Those syllables are my distillation of adaptation. Now, when it comes to the behavioral space, I want to end on this point, and this is an idea from theatre, from being a performer myself, is the idea of behaviour as character. Maybe in order to take on and let go of characters, we need to get a little bit more playful, as Laura said yesterday, about who we think we are. So what I want to put to you as the final point is our loss aversion is fundamentally about our aversion to losing an idea of ourselves. It's identity that we clutch to and fasten to most powerfully. So when we're working adaptively, when we're working in the difficult work of mobilizing people to tackle tough challenges and thrive, please know that, and you'll know this already, many of you, you're running up against people's loss aversion. to who they know themselves, who I know myself to be. And even if it's the position of a coffee machine or the sense that I am a responsible steward of land in being a farmer, or am I? That's an identity-shattering question mark to place at the end of this, at least for me. Thank you.
Do you want to start?
One, two.
Testing.
So we have four microphones, five people. Can you hear me all right at the back? Great, excellent.
Just for the second, but mostly the talking's happening up here. So hence you've got the mic. So that's a great range of stimulation, content, ideas. I think Anant's really embodied that at the end beautifully. Thank you for... extending on the coffee theme, my anxiety levels are absolutely high. So we've got two questions where we want to tease now out these ideas further and have the panel discuss, ideally amongst themselves, these two ways of trying to tie this all together. So the first one touches on, I think... the matter of scale might be one way of describing it that's come through several of the presenters. So how is it that we can work and communicate with individuals about making meaningful change? And I think meaningful in the sense of the context or in the circumstances. What is our ecological niche at the moment? Well, as we've talked about, it's planetary. The scale of what we're grappling with is planetary. So we're thinking about that, but at the same time, we're wanting to communicate and work with individuals about change and groups and organisations and networks and nations and all of those things, but we're engaging with individuals. So this idea of scale from the personal to the planetary. And so how do we, and it comes back to the question, how do we work and communicate with individuals, with persons, to bring about meaningful change, but change in a context and of a scale that essentially needs to be planetary. Who'd like to, kick us off?
Oh, you're going to have to nominate someone.
You drafted that question. That's Laura's.
Wow. I've never had this happen before.
Okay, I'm going to have a go.
Okay, great.
I think Sarah's looking at me. What Sarah Burrows and Anita Taylor are doing with their meat processing, they're going to talk to you about later, links to this. So the space I'm working in is about looking at sustainable agricultural practices, regenerative agricultural practices, and... apparently, it's been a United Nations development goal forever. And on a global scale, we still, I don't know the exact details, but we still do not know how to assess whether a farmer's managing their land sustainably. Like, that is just insane. And so I think as individuals, there's a bit of a talk about making big choices about the kind of meat we eat or the kind of food we consume. And so I'm currently involved in a couple of projects where we're looking at doing assessments of sustainability on farms and making it pretty as robust as we can. It's challenging. But as we get more stuff available to consumers, I think people want to tap into those markets, and that gets a conversation going. It means people can actually make a meaningful choice and vote with their dollars, and it just starts a little bit of a shift in broader culture, not just among the groups like this. So that's a start to it.
Charles.
Yeah, I'd like to pick up on another tension that Rachel and Anantha raised, which is, Rachel, your idea of that superorganism, I think that's a great concept. And what's reinforcing that is this philosophy of neoliberalism, economic rationalism, all the great powers of the world, the biggest institutions are driving that. And then we come to Anant's point about individual feelings of loss. So a lot of our identity personally is driven by those powers through the media, advertising and all the rest, and their devices. So I guess it's a pet belief of mine, because my previous book was on the political destruction of the wool industry, Australia's biggest disaster, $20 billion economic disaster, covered up by seven federal governments and driven by angry politicians. So I have little faith the solutions are going to come from the top, whether it be governance, UN, just because of the powers involved and those belief systems. So that's why I emphasise this bottom-up revolution. It's us as landscape managers, as people in urban or peri-urban areas who are growing or demanding food, and then the way that we start to set up new structures, we have to recreate, if you like, how this new superorganism has to shift before it's too late. So it's an interesting tension you guys have raised.
It's, in a sense, we're back into a Kropotkin-style anarchism, because you have to remember Kropotkin actually wrote a book about evolution, and his... His idea was that really cooperation, that it was cooperation that actually drove evolution as much as competition, and I think we're, because there have been so many changes, because there's so many different media now, there are so many ways now that you can contact the world. You can every day of my life now, at various points during the day, I'm in contact with and in conversations with people all over the world through social media. There are these mechanisms to actually build up series of small disconnected groups, or rather small discrete groups that are connected in networks, right? And I think that's the way we've got to work. All of those things seem isolated, but they're not as isolated, because each one connects to the next one. They're grids and networks, right? So we've got to start thinking in the world in terms of grids and networks, and that we're creating a whole different grid and network under this overwhelming structure, which we know is not functional anymore. And so we're modelling and building this whole new way of working and operating underneath it all. And it's full, you know, as Charlie said, there's huge amounts of redundancy and failure, and this is the joy of failure. You know, 99% of this stuff is going to fail, but we just keep throwing out ideas and throwing out, you know, efforts, you know, like a Catherine wheel, you know, and some of them will eventually build up into bigger things, you know, and they'll provide this layer of stuff that will create the critical mass, which, when the critical mass appears, everything else just solves itself almost instantly. It's that weird thing. You think nothing is ever going to change, and all of a sudden, bang, it's gone. Think of the gay marriage thing. It's the perfect example of it, you know? Absolutely unthinkable thing 10 years ago, and then suddenly just done, gone, like that.
I'm okay.
Yeah.
Got to know when to shut up, too.
This is good. So you've therapeutically put us in this really uncomfortable situation where even moving a coffee machine is a problem.
Yeah.
Now he's okay.
I don't know where to stand with this guy. So there's a couple of points that we've touched on there in terms of this personal to planetary, from Rachel touching on just one example of, were we to have a green tick that said this tomato, this 50-gram slice of grass-fed beef, green tick, that's come from a sustainable food system, imagine it the whole way through, then great. And so that's a vision to move toward that. At a personal level, I'm playing a part in a planetary shift, UN scale. Charlie's come back to this superorganism, this cultural superorganism, and so what actually holds that collaboration together, our culture, our shared story. And then Ian's talking about networks, communication, where this story actually is created and recreated day in, day out, and it's constantly jostling to change. So I want to challenge you all now with another question, which is, what's an element for you of this new story then?
Damon used the word yesterday, I think he used it a couple of times, and that word is leadership. And I just want to take 20 seconds to unpack that. Conventionally, when we think about leadership, we think about it in the sense of authority, the power and influence to get things done. I'd like for us to break open that carapace and understand that we all have an intuitive feeling that leadership is something that you do. It's a verb. And you hear it when people say, oh, so-and-so shows leadership. Or, you know, that was a real act of leadership. These are, the verb is packed into it. But at other times, we hear things like, oh, they're a leader, or we need leadership. So what I want to suggest as a response to this question is, well, we need to separate leadership as a function, as a verb, as a practice, from authority. Like politicians, big agribusiness, the top end of town, all these shorthands. So once we split leadership as a verb and leadership as a noun, we start to see that, as you're all saying, we're actually in right now a act of many people's leadership. Like this very festival is an expression of artistic and scientific leadership. It doesn't take authority for us to hang out under this marquee and have this conversation. And that's something that I'm really excited about breaking apart.
So I'll take that as this new story, this new narrative, that just following on this thread that Charles has kicked us off with, then there's a unpacking of the, what did you call the carapace?
Yeah, that's just stealing.
So what leadership means culturally to us, you're saying let's change that up.
Yes.
You're the leaders. We're the leaders.
I'd like to add another bit to that, right, which is be modest leaders, right? I actually think it's time for humans to start getting modest. And in one of our earlier things in Futurelands 2, if you had to actually say what the Futurelands 2 theme was, this was a weekend, I suppose most of you know, or might have been there, another weekend we did talking about agriculture in a very general sense. The underlying theme of it in a way was, how do we actually turn Australian agriculture into a contemporary version of Aboriginal agriculture, where in fact we become, rather than miners and managers, we become like gardeners, you know, who just look after the place, right? And then, you know, we can get things from that to survive. But we stop having this sort of heroic notion of ourselves. Instead, we become its servants, you know, and its attendants, right? And I think that's something that humanity has to start getting its head around in some way or another. And that will be very, very, very difficult cultural mode to change, even though it's a cultural mode which exists in most, probably in most Indigenous cultures, but it doesn't exist in Western, you know, liberal capitalist culture at all.
Yeah, I'd like to endorse and announce you've really raised a great issue, which Ian's picked up on. If you think about 1940 and Churchill's rhetoric in the darkest hour, so to speak, that galvanised the nation, the threat was blindingly obvious, you know, the backs were to the wall. The current threat isn't, not to the majority. And so rhetoric and so-called top-down leadership has a different role, and the leadership has to be what you guys have just articulated. It's got to be at the individual level. We all have to be the leaders we want to be to make the change we want.
I've actually largely forgotten what the question was, but I do. But just to quickly say,
well, you can be the random variant.
I think it relates. I'm just so struck by Anant's concept of thinking about these change adaptation that we have to make is there's a whole lot of loss, because probably psychologically, if you don't acknowledge people's fear of losing that, you're just getting, there's a barrier there. So I think that's powerful to understand that people are afraid of losing stuff. So in the conversations about it, I think it's a very powerful thought.
Can I just add one quick little bit to this? I mean, most of you are too young to really remember what happened with the Green Band movement, but the thing about the Green Band movement, it was just like a wave that overwhelmed Sydney in 2 or 3 years. And what happened was there was a huge a surge of development in Sydney in the late 60s and the early 70s. Buildings were being knocked down everywhere, all over the place, and all sorts of new ones being built. It was pretty much uncontrolled development. What happened was that a community group actually approached the Builders Labourers Union and asked them to not knock down an area called Kelly's Bush in Hunters Hill. So it was middle class. It was basically middle class women trying to protect a local area of bushland in a very wealthy Sydney suburb. But the union actually thought, well, you know, they'd asked us to do it. It was actually a good thing to do, you know. And so they basically put a ban on working on the area. Slowly at first, and then more and more accelerating, this started to happen all through the whole inner city area. Not just individual buildings, but entire suburbs slowly had green bands put on them. And the condition was that the union would never take an action on its own, but if there was an on-the-ground organised community group that had reasons, valid reasons, and was organised that and asked for it, then the union would discuss helping them. And so soon, almost the whole inner city area of Sydney was covered with green bands, which blocked development. And, of course, as you would expect, that all went wrong in the end because it mobilised huge forces against them. But the interesting thing about it was how much on-the-ground leadership there was, how much all of these people, given the opportunity to act, came out of the woodwork and organised and did things. And it showed that there was a huge surge of resentment underlying all this stuff, which had never had a way to mobilise and act itself out until suddenly here was a way it could actually happen. And all through those inner city areas, and to this day, there are all these veterans of it, you know, these people who lived through it all and who remember it because it was a bit like going to war, but it was going to war for really good reasons, for your own community and forming all these alliances that all sorts of people just suddenly discovered aspects of themselves and their ability to do things that they'd never thought were there.
So it's a great example of the leadership, what becomes viral almost, that tipping point of community by community. But I want to challenge our speakers a little bit because I think it's been too easy to this point. It's a great example, coming back to Anant's unpacking of this change process, of what are we holding on to, what are we holding dear, but this concept of loss. So what if the change we're envisaging requires us to let go of and lose some things, enables us to keep and hold dear some things, and then this idea of growth. So what's the difference that is achieved? And it's interesting Ananth used the term growth, because in the evolutionary science, another one of the messages that's coming out really clearly, and we know this, what success looks like for biology in evolution is survival. So we're still here, so we've succeeded, evolutionarily speaking, just now, for the moment. So growth biologically, reproduction from singular cell to a couple of trillion organism species, is success. Biological success, like so innate, so instinctive, so we don't know it's even happening. So coming back to the change we're envisaging, what is the growth? Like what's the allure there of growth? And what's the loss and the letting go? And what's the keeping and holding dear looking like here? Now that's a huge question, but if we could just do the holding and keeping, I just want to keep this land, I just want to keep this bush, I just want to keep this climate, well then that'd be kind of too easy for us because we're only focusing on part of it. So holding, letting go, and then the growth, the creating of the new. So how do we do this? What's your response to that?
30 seconds.
I'll put it really quickly. I'm 98.4, give or take a bit, bonobo chimpanzee, and so are you. Nature is really conservative.
We're 2% Neanderthal as well.
Well, yeah, it depends on which, you know, genetic pool you're talking about. I might be a bit more, but I just want to put as a response to that really profound question. I'm going to say, embrace your inner conservative. Not necessarily in the Burkean political sense, but to start framing our language so that it encodes preservation in it. So instead of climate change being a threat, I'd rather us talk about civilizational collapse, because the folks like on some aisles of politics who have opened up Ramsey centres at the University of Wollongong really, really care about civilization. So put that front and centre and say what we really care about is preserving this civilization, because what it does is it quells some of the worry, because then people go, oh, these people aren't revolutionaries. Oh, good. We can do business with them. So what I want to say is, you know, let's start articulating what's going to be kept rather than articulating what we need to stop all the time or what we need to do more of all the time. So if we start articulating what will be preserved, well, then it'll act as a delivery mechanism for what's grown or what is lost.
I'm going to really throw a spanner in the those works. one of the fundamental... people are born, mature, die, right? One of the fundamental things of understanding evolution is you have to understand that species are born and mature and die, right? The extinction is as fundamental to evolution as the process of adaptation and change. Maybe, you know, we've just got to face the fact that the human race is going to go extinct before too long, you know, and that this, as I was saying earlier on, things are at their strongest before they collapse. I mean, we're at this point where maybe this is just, you know, we're in plague proportions and we've destroyed our own environment and it can't support us anymore and we are going to go, right? Now, that doesn't mean that some tiny remnant might continue to exist in some form, but it will itself be in the process of changing. And I think from what I know of the biology of this, that in fact humans are a bit of a sort of biological dead end anyway, you know, and no, I mean that quite literally, as things branch off that sort of hominid tree, you know, like we may move, you know, we're out on a limb somewhere, you know, and once the limb goes, we're gone too, you know. And so you have to actually get your head around this, right, and get a bit of joy of despair, you know, like just stop torturing yourself about how bad it is and just, you know, sort of smooth the pillow of the dying race. And
I can't believe he just said that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, we really might have to seriously think. Well, we do have to seriously think about how we wind this down.
Yeah. All right. That's the homo nihilism.
Yeah. Thanks for that. And as just said, Sunday morning. It's good. We've got a challenge. Over to you, Charlie.
I'm going to date myself here because I was a kid in the 50s and we were pretty self-sufficient. Make your own bread, milk a cow, grow most of your vegetables and your fruit. And quite frankly, the damage that's being done to Earth's systems is being done by the richer civilizations, which are high consumer, high resource users. And if we want to turn things around, we're going to have to start doing without. Do we need, or does it make us any happier? Netflix, Facebook, our comfortable consumer, plastic items, et cetera, et cetera. We have to go back to a far more simple lifestyle. And when you look at communities that are doing it who aren't privileged but are self-sufficient, and I had the privilege a few months back of living in a remote village in southern France for a while and saw a pretty self-sufficient community that interacted and supported and was self-sufficient. But when you look at communities that, including urban societies that go back and grow their own food and collaboratively walk together and strip away all this dross that we call necessities and consumer items, they're actually a lot happier. And that's, to answer Nan's point of view, that's what we've got to start shedding if we're going to help turn things around.
Yeah, I agree.
So, yeah.
So if I really distill that down, part of this new narrative is greater happiness, sort of inner contentment than...
Less is more.
Yeah, okay. And the more, the grow, which is what the question was about, you're pointing to happiness, essentially. Yep, lovely. Rach?
I don't have too much to say because I pretty much agree with everything Charlie just said. But if we bring it back to evolution... Growth is the early phase, isn't it, of a species? And then it slows down. And then if we bring it back to this fear of losing, but if you flip that around, what are we going to gain? We know, like, that the richer civilizations are the least happy. Well, the statistics say, and I think it's probably pretty true. So as well as acknowledging what we're going to lose, let's start focusing on what people can gain from that, slowing that growth. Make it a spiritual, whatever, but something positive from that slowing down of growth.
And we need our big shit stirrers with a wooden spoon like Ian here deliberately to keep challenging us.
Look, I mean, obviously I cannot in any way at all speak for Aboriginal culture, but there's a real point there, which is a culture which is materially very poor, very low in physical material culture, incredibly high and rich, and unimaginably high and rich in immaterial culture, right? In stories and songs and intangible culture, right? That's the model.
So it is Spotify and Netflix.
Maybe so, that's the transition.
So, a bit serious though, a thread that's just come through there is, so where that community? I mean, historically we've thought about communities in a geographic place sense, and that's still at any moment where we are, but here we are in this place as a community. Here we are as leading and creating the change. This new culture, new story, we're all leaders. We're not waiting for some beneficial bloody dictator. I'm so over that idiom. And so we better have a really good time together because everyone's watching us. And if we're happy, we're the new story and they'll want to get some of the action. But if we're all up each other's tailpipes, then we're not a very alluring bunch, are we? That was rhetorical. I know we haven't had time for questions from you. I apologise for that, but I really wanted to let that go. I thought that was the most stimulating discussion. Our speakers are all here, I think, for the day, so there's an opportunity to talk and mill amongst yourselves. So please do approach any of them with questions that you've got we didn't have time for, and please thank
Charles, Ian, Rachel, and Anand.
Thank you.